As if cycling around the world wasn't hard enough, Marcus Stitz did it on a single-speed bike. 21,000 miles and deliberately avoiding any notion that he'd achieve a Guinness World Record. I'm Simon Willis, and I met Marcus last year on Ride to the Sun, and then again at an event he organises. I'd like to quickly sum him up. A bike racer, a marketing expert, a trail coordinator, and he is all those things, but he's more complicated than that. Growing up in East Germany, close to the Iron Curtain, he knew what it was to have restricted freedom. Perhaps that's why he craves it now. Even if it does mean going around the world the hard way, on a bicycle with no gears.
I think for me, and this is a very subjective thing potentially, is I just love the simplicity, if you can describe it as simplicity. It's a bike, it's got one gear. All of my single speeds have a steel drivetrain, so the chain is steel, the chain ring on the front is steel, and the freewheel as well. Which basically, for anyone who doesn't have a clue about bikes, means that's a material which is unlikely to break. It's possibly a little bit heavier, but it's just, yeah, I just love the simplicity. And the other thing I love as well is just you don't really have an alternative. You just have to deal with things as they come to you. So whenever you go on a short or long ride, you don't potentially do not know how many big hills there are in the way. But I just love that I have one gear. I've got no alternative. I just have to make it up the hill, make it down the hill on the flat straight with the same setup. And I think that's for me personally, still after 10 years of riding single speed, it's a fascinating thing to do.
But is it not so much harder physically, especially when you're carrying stuff with you on some of these long distance routes, going around the world, for example? I mean, is it not that much harder when you get to a hill? How do you cope? Is what I'm saying. And when you're going downhill, do you not find times when your legs are spinning like over 100 RPM just to keep going?
It is, I think, I think from the outside, it is, and I think it's fair to say that it is harder to a certain extent than riding any bike where you've got gears in some shape or form. Because basically, if you've got gears, you can, if you go up a hill, you can make your life a little bit easier. And if you go down a hill, you can switch in a smaller gear and you're slightly faster. So that's a fair thing to say. Although I do think there's one thing about the single speed, and I've been observing that since I've been riding single speed bikes, which is about 10 years now, is that it made me a much better cyclist, or not just a cyclist, just I think generally as an athlete or just as a person, because in terms of cycling, the big advantage I think is you become much more steady in what you do. So you are much more like whenever, and I ride geared bikes as well every now and then, is I just found myself in a position, you have to shift gears all the time. I have to think about what you're doing. So like in a sense, the single speed makes you focus on one thing, and that is cycling. And so you don't have to, once you're on the bike, you just ride it. And to get across the thing, the only thing I do deliberately is I choose my gearing, knowing roughly what kind of terrain I expect. So if I know I'm going to ride on a flat road for 1,000 kilometers, then it doesn't make sense to use a gearing like I used on the round the world trip, which is 30 to 18. So that lets me ride uphill up to 13-14%. To anyone who doesn't know what that means, that's a pretty steep hill already. On tarmac, if it's gravel or some off-road conditions, then it's even harder. So I kind of choose my gearing in order to what kind of terrain I'm roughly expecting. And that's about it. Obviously, if you ride downhill, that's always easier. If you've got a single-speed bike, you just don't pedal. That's fine. If you go uphill, I pedal as much as I can. If it gets too steep on the road, then I normally zigzag. If I can, so if it's a busy main road, I wouldn't do that, but majority of my riding is not on such roads, so I can zigzag up, so that makes it a little bit easier, so you take a little bit of sting out. If that doesn't work, then I can do half turns, or if I'm on a busy road, that's kind of the last resort, really. And to be honest, if that all fails and the hill's too steep, then it's a good excuse to get off, push your bike, enjoy the countryside. And I've done a fair few races on the Singer's Beat now. If it gets that steep and you push your bike, you're as quick as someone who's cycling up in their 30-50 ratio. So, you know, I think I think it's a nice, sometimes it's a welcome excuse to kind of say, look, I'm just going to get off and push and enjoy what's around me. I think for me, that's anyhow the most important thing in whatever I'm doing, not just cycling.
I filmed Jason Miles a few times, and he won the Strathpuffer as a solo, on a single speed. I think he did it twice or maybe three times like that, and he just said it was just so much simpler. Nothing went wrong with it, but again, like you have to be a good cyclist.
Yeah.
Why did you want to do around the world on a single speed? Was it the two things together? Did you just want to go around the world and you were pedaling single speed bikes, or was it that you wanted to get some sort of place in history as going around the world on a single speed? Which was it?
I do think a combination of both, although like getting a place in history wasn't really the aim of the trip. I started riding single speed about 5 years before the around the world trip, and when it came to eventually making the decision to go around the world, I wanted to choose a bike. I was also working, or a good friend of mine back then, Pat Jocelyn, was brand manager for 30 Bikes in the UK. And we've been chatting on and off about this trip. And when it actually came to the decision I want to do it, I spoke to him and said, look, I trust your knowledge. I do have a fair bit of knowledge about bicycles as well, but I want to go out for a year cycling around the world. Can we come up with a bike which suits my needs? You know, you've got the industry knowledge. I know what I want to ride. I know what I want to do on the around the world trip, roughly. And so we kind of like very quickly decided on the bike. And then, it came to the decision whether I'm going to take a single speed or geared bike. And I had already in my mind kind of made the decision that, if I can take a single speed bike, that's a pretty interesting thing to do. I wasn't aware of anyone's done it on a single speed bike, although I am very cautious still with saying I've been the first person cycling around the world on a single speed bike, because I'm pretty sure there have been people who've been doing it before the internet was there, before or simply people who possibly not documented their trip. You know, they might have just gone out and done it, and that's it. So
not everybody seeks the publicity of that, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's totally fine. That's why I'm you know, I've done it on a single speed. So yeah, doing it on a single speed was part of the attraction, and doing it on the bike. I think it's safe to say that not many people have chosen a single speed bike to go around the world, and I think in a way that fascinated me to kind of just simply see. Is it possible? And it is totally possible. It's possibly also harder, although I can't compare that. You know, I could only compare that if I've cycled around the world on a geared bike as well. And I also didn't choose, and I think that is what a few people surprised, and especially people who kind of are experts in the field. I chose a really hilly route. Like, I had 342,000 meters of climbing over. Well, the initial cycling time was about a bit more than 10 and a half months, which is a lot of climbing each day.
Which way did you go?
On average. I went the opposite direction to everyone else. Basically, I started in Scotland, went across the UK, across France, basically from north to south, down to Barcelona. And then I flew to Iceland, did a loop in Iceland. So I didn't cycle across Iceland. I just had 10 days in Iceland for cycling. I just wanted to do something to get to know the country a little bit better. And then I did fly from Iceland to New York. And then I crossed the US from the east to the west coast. So my trip was basically going the opposite direction that loads of people who do a similar thing do. And it was down to the seasons, because I started in September. I handed in my notice in March. I had 3 months notice period, finished my job in June, had 2 months preparation, and off I was on the bike. And I didn't want to spend loads and loads of time planning. So September was a good time to leave. I also, it was nice having a summer in Scotland and then heading off. So I was leaving being fairly fit and not somehow in January or February where it was quite miserable and cold. And then I went from New York over to San Francisco, from San Francisco to Auckland, and then crossed New Zealand north to south.
Right. And that was your antipodal point to somewhere in Spain, presumably.
Yeah. Although, again, I mean, one thing I was quite deliberate about, I didn't want to set a Guinness World Record. Oh, okay. I could have done it would have been not an easy thing to do, but it would have been. But the trip wasn't about a world record. The trip was more for me to do it. And doing a world record would have given me some restrictions I could have potentially lived with. But I just simply, I left a very busy, full-on marketing job to do this. And the last thing I wanted to do is spending each day documenting what I'm doing and writing down numbers. So, I cycled everything. There's a record for that as well. But parts of the route were not going in one consistent direction, for example, in Iceland. I ended up cycling much more than would have been required for a world record. I cycled 34,000 kilometers instead of 29,000, I think, is the distance needed.
That's over 21,000 miles. That's quite a way. Yeah.
But as I said before, this wasn't about, there are numbers and, you know, they are fascinating for people and they're also, I'm still fascinated by the amount of climbing.
Oh, by the way, I interrupted you. You were in New Zealand. Yeah. Where did you go from there?
Talking about climbing, so from New Zealand, got a little bit flatter. I cycled from Sydney to Perth in Australia and then from Perth over to Singapore with a plane and then Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, Laos, and Vietnam. And then that was my last plane journey from Hanoi to Tehran in Iran. And then I cycled basically all the way back from Tehran across Iran, Turkey, Europe. And then I could have taken this trade road because I was born and raised in Germany. I was very keen to start and finish in Edinburgh because that's my home. That's where my life or the center of my life's been in the last 10 years. But I also wanted to include Germany to a certain extent into the trip because it's a huge chunk of my life. And it was obviously really nice to be there. And I also was lucky enough that with some things that had changed within the trip, I ended up being in Germany for my birthday, which was quite so. And then from Germany, I could have gone straight back to Edinburgh the quickest way, but I chose to go over Ireland and Northern Ireland and back this way into Scotland just to kind of include. Yeah, I just like the idea of not rushing things through. So and then back to Edinburgh.
Are you particularly happy in your own head when you're doing these things, because you're a long time on a bike?
Yeah, I love it. It's great. And that's where I'm a happy space. I think it's interesting with the current situation we are in, where people are having to isolate themselves. I've got no issue with that. I'm used to that from long bike rides. I'm by myself. I'm possibly the happiest by myself. It's an interesting thing because I think one thing you need to understand there is being by yourself and there's being lonely. And I tend to not to get lonely. I do get lonely every now and then. It's just I'm a human being like anyone else, and I think we are social people, and seeking social interaction is an essential ingredient, I think, into human life. But at the same time, I love being by myself. I love making my own decisions. I'm a person who is also happy to live with the consequences of my decisions. So again, if you're going around the world for a year, the likeliness of making decisions that are possibly not your greatest decisions is high. That happens. But I think I'm also the sort of person who is kind of, I can live with that and kind of put one day to the side and it's every another day. So yeah, I love it. And I think that's like, I mean, obviously going on a trip like this, being on the bike or being out there for almost a year by yourself, you need to be comfortable in your own skin. Otherwise, I think it's just going to end in a small disaster at some stage. So yeah, I love that. It's nice.
You mentioned growing up in Germany. You actually grew up in yeah. East Germany, where with almost in sight of the border, the one that you couldn't cross. I read your blog post about this, and that experience seemed to shape your attitudes towards freedom and the ability to go where you wanted. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a huge, it's freedom for me. It's the most important ingredient in my life. And due to the fact that I've spoken to quite a lot of people about that, and it's quite difficult, I think, especially for people who've been growing up in Western societies that had the freedom all the time. Is basically, I grew up as a child with very little materialistic things, which I actually really appreciate. In terms of we could go to the shops and could buy things, all the essential ingredients, they were there. But when it came to things like bananas, for example, it's quite interesting. So growing up East Germany as a child, if you wanted a banana, there were possibly three or four times in a year where the shops had bananas and we had to queue up for them for 3 to 4 hours. I had two siblings, my brother and sister, so for us it was actually quite a social experience that we would go out and queue. But I think what I realized when the wall finally came down, there was such an important event for me, because I realized, that's not what I realized as a 10-year-old, that's what I realized. It was the selflessness of people that brought this to an end. There were people there who wanted their own freedom, but they also wanted other people to have the freedom. And this is essentially what happened in Germany in 1988, 1989. People were fed up with the system, with a totalitarian system, and they said, we don't want this, we want... And they went to the streets, they put their own life at risk in order for other people to get that freedom. And I was a 10-year-old boy back then. And I think this is the thing I realized. This has been such a massive gift in my life. If that wouldn't have happened at this stage, especially, I wouldn't have got the university education I had. I wouldn't have had the ability to do an internship in New York, to study in England, to travel around the world on my bicycle, to be able to live in Scotland. So my life would have been a totally different life, possibly quite miserable, because I'm also the sort of person who is happy to say my own opinion. And that was the thing that wasn't appreciated in East Germany. So I think this stayed with me for such a long time, and still does. And it's also influenced pretty much everything I've been doing since then. I've always been very, very happy that I can do all of those things. But I also get quite careful if people trying to take away that freedom in some shape or form. And this is why I think the situation for me. And I mentioned that when I woke up on Monday. Under the impression, right, I am now sitting in my home being told what to do. I totally understand for good reasons, and I'm really happy to oblige. I haven't left my home since Sunday. But I think it was just a really weird feeling that, because it kind of brought back the memories from East Germany, where you're not allowed to travel everywhere whatsoever. So it's, this whole concept of freedom has been such a massive influence.
That's why I really wanted you to talk about those freedoms, because we are all experiencing restrictions on our own freedoms at the moment. And it's not East Germany. And there's a good reason for it. Yeah. How did you end up in Edinburgh?
Oh, this is a short and long story. I mentioned before, I studied in England. I studied in Sunderland for half a year as an exchange student for the university I was studying in Germany. I had an exchange program with them. Sunderland is okay.
Careful, that's my neck of the woods down there.
Yeah, it's lovely. To be honest with you, this is another thing that's shaped my life. Like, I essentially believe you can basically... if you've got the right people in a place, you can basically live anywhere in the world and, you know, have a good time. And it's really up to you how you approach people. That's also the kind of thing. But Sunderland, the good thing about it being in Northeast England is you're very close to the Scottish border. So I jumped on the train a couple of times, went up to Edinburgh. And I was fascinated by the city. It's such an amazing place. I love the architecture. I love the vibe up here. So once I finished my studies, I went back to Germany. I was running a music festival for quite a while. And then I went to New Zealand. But what happened after my visit in Sunderland, that in 2005, I came back from an internship in New York, and I had a month to spare, and I was just kind of like, I really like Edinburgh, there's a festival going on, this might be a good opportunity to find a short-term temp job. And I got one working at the box office, and that was in 2005. Came back to work at the Fringe Festival ever since then. And then in 2009, when I came back from New Zealand with the intention to live in Europe, this was as broad as that. I had a job offer in Edinburgh at the International Festival and came back here and, yeah, stayed ever since then.
When did cycling come into your life? Because I'm guessing you're not the kind of lad who was, as a teenager, was doing all the young races. Or were you? I don't know.
No, I did go all, to be honest with you, when it came to exercise. My mum's a music teacher. I was a very, like, arts, but it's kind of like the kind of more dominant part of my life. It came in 2000 and, oh no, hold on, 1990, no, in 2000, actually, because I went to university. I learned to cycle as a child, so pretty much everyone in Germany, I know, learned to cycle as a child. It took me a long time to do that. I think it took a lot of patience from my dad and my mom as well. And then I cycled as a child, but I was never in a club. Possibly the longest distance I cycled was about 15, 20 kilometers. And that was it. And, you know, I liked it, but it was also not a passion. Like, I would possibly be more happy to sit in my room and construct something with Lego bricks or do other things. And then first year at university, after two semesters, possibly the inevitable happened that I had to take care of myself, had to cook my own food, and I possibly wasn't the most careful person. So, you know, put on a few pounds, and then I essentially came up with the decision myself, I need to do something about this. I want to get fitter. What am I going to do? And a good friend of mine, who I commuted to university back and forth with, she was a super fast runner. She's a track and field athlete. And I said to her, look, can you take me running? And she was a bit flabbergasted by the whole thing. So I started running. I was rubbish at it to begin with. But very quickly, I think in terms of personalities, once I do something, I would like to be good at it. I've done various things in my life, not just exercise. And it was always, I tried to do it in the best possible way. And it's the same. And I knew that the same is going to happen with exercise as well. So I started running, did run my first marathon about half a year later. And then got a little bit bored by it, and it kind of dusted off my mountain bike again, because it was a beautiful area where I lived in Germany, very close to nature, a bit like living in Edinburgh, to be honest. So, yeah, I took up mountain biking and then went from 20, 30 kilometer rides to 100 kilometers. And left it like this, and then gradually when I finished university and went to New Zealand, I took up like cycle touring over there, and kind of the distances increased with the number of years. And then when I returned to Scotland, and I think this is interesting, so up until then I was like, I did a lot of cycle touring in New Zealand, some bikepacking potentially as well, although I didn't have the fancy bags I have right now. I chucked everything in a backpack, which was heavy and at times impractical as well, but it's fine. It's the same principle. You know, you still have to reduce yourself to a certain amount of things. And then I came back to Scotland in 2009, didn't do any cycling at all because I eventually came here and I wasn't sure if I'm going to stay in Edinburgh, so I didn't want to carry everything with me. And then I got my road bike, and then I ended up doing quite a number of years just simply spending on the road cycling. And then in 2013, I think it was, I gradually eased back into the off-road stuff as well. And right now, it doesn't really matter. It kind of really depends on how I feel, which bike I grab. It could be on the road, could be off-road, could be single speed fixed or with gears, whatever.
Which of your 8 bikes, yeah. I seem to remember you mentioned on your blog.
Yeah, I think it's 8 at the moment, yeah. I need to shed down some. I'm actually, one of the projects, I'm hopefully, which is possibly a little bit more delayed, but I think I am working with a local frame builder at the moment, trying to find a bike which will do all the jobs at once, so I can literally have one bike that does pretty much everything. If that's going to be reality, I'm not sure yet, but that's an ambition for 2020. Let's see how that goes.
I follow you on social media, and it seems to me you are the very definition of a man with many, many jobs, because you've got a marketing background, and you've done, I suppose, proper jobs for companies in marketing, but you kind of seem to be doing lots of bits and bobs for other people. You are designing and organizing trails for Perthshire and Kinross, and among others that you've done through Argyle. You're running events. You organized the Dirt Dash, which I did last year with, and it kind of like wonder how you managed to keep all these. And then you go off on your own races, and you did the Silk Road race. Was that last year? Gosh, yes, it was the end of last year, or was it early this year? Yeah. I can't remember now. Yeah. I kind of wonder how you managed to juggle all this.
It's not easy, and I think I think I'm just like just so. There's one reason for doing quite a lot of things at the same time is that I think I don't want to put all my eggs in one basket. My background, I studied media communication science and then slipped into marketing professionally and did that for quite a long time. I've also managed a music festival for 5 years. So there was marketing, sponsorship, musical direction and stuff like this. So I've always been a person who loves change. I'm not adverse to change, and I think this is a really, really useful skill to have. Like, I can think outside the box. I can put myself into various different roles where people are, and it's something that's been super beneficial, especially in the last 5 years. I do many things at the same time. I used to have a corporate, never really had a corporate job as such, but I used to have like a full-time job. And then, like, I think in a way, the round the world trip was a good year for me to kind of think about what I want to do with my life. Although it wasn't a decision like I'm going to completely change my life when I come back. I just kind of happened to find freelance work and found more projects. So at the moment I'm working for a museum, the David Livingstone Birthplace in Glasgow, which is a very marketing, social media focused job. And I love that because it's got nothing to do with cycling. So I can put myself into a totally different world. I do my races. I'm a freelance writer. I'm a photographer. I'm a videographer. So whenever I'm off on the bike, I try to document that, try to write about it, make films about it as well, whenever that's possible. And I guess the most inspiring, or the kind of the project which is very much what Marcus is about, is Bikepacking Scotland.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about that. The Bikepacking Scotland thing. Tell me all about that. Just even getting that URL puts you in a great place, because bikepacking is the thing of the moment in cycling, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that was a direct result. So when I came back from the round the world trip, it took me a few months to kind of get settled back again And then in November, I thought about what do I want to do? And the good thing is, like, before I went around the world trip, I developed the Capital Trail around Edinburgh, developed the route, did run an event on it, and the feedback from people was great, which was lovely. And in that year, while I was out on the round the world trip, actually, I had a honorable mention or whatever. And I'm not the sort of person who really is kind of looking to get awards for things like this. I'm the sort of person who's very, very quiet personally. I'm happy to market other people, but I'm not really confident and comfortable with marketing myself as such. I got a mention for my trip. But the thing which was the most inspiring thing is that the Capital Trail got mentioned by bikepacking.com as one of the best new routes in that year. And I was quiet, and it kind of gave me the confidence to kind of say, okay, I've done one route, and I love Scotland. There's so much potential in Scotland to in terms of routes which are existing. There's so many heritage paths, general roads, military roads network, Coffin roads, any kind of ancient routes, and most of them are all still there. So I did a lot of research into this, and then I was thinking about why is no one really doing anything with this stuff? And, you know, because bikepacking was still a very, very fresh thing back then. And then I thought, like, well, I've got a marketing background, so that is obviously quite beneficial in order to get the word out there. And I've also got a really keen interest in Scotland, in Scotland's history and all this stuff. And also I'm a sort of person who... I'm thriving from human stories. I love talking to people. I'm happy to spend, at the moment that's not possible, I'm happy to spend an evening in a pub with someone in a region where I've never been and just kind of, like, you know, talk to people, get to know the place much better. So I thought, like, you know, I love all of those things. Those are perfect ingredients for kind of looking a little bit more into developing new routes, because I think the reality is that people... I think bikepacking has become more and more popular, but people also don't necessarily have the time to research all the things by themselves, and that's fine, because...
Marcus, if I can interrupt you, there is the other thing about bikepacking in Scotland, is because of our mapping, a track on the map does not necessarily mean rideable. You might be carrying it for so long. And that's a big thing when people have to do it themselves. I mean, I quite like doing that around here, but I certainly wouldn't do it fully laden with a full-on bikepacking thing. I think that's why they like it as well.
Yeah, so I had this idea, and I had a look. The URL was still available, and I thought, like, right, I'm going to get the URL. And I'll do something with it. I wasn't entirely sure how this is all going to work. And then I think the crucial bit, there were two events that happened in 2017. So I came back from the round the world trip in 2016. That was in September. So it took me a few months to get back settled into normal life. And then in February 2017, I met a guy called Tal de Bordes, who is a farmer, or he manages a farm in the Scottish Borders. Really nice guy from the Netherlands. And we were at a tourism event together, and he said to me, look, so I told him a little bit about what I would like to do. And he said to me, look, I can't give you any financial help, but I've got a couple of cottages. They're not busy in March. If you want to come down, spend as much time as you would like to spend in a cottage and just try to find some rideable stuff in the Airwater Valley, so that's where his farm is based, then I'm really happy to get you down here. We can potentially organize a little bit of budget for filming. And that's what I did. So I spent a week down there, researched the route, which is now on the Bikepacking Scotland website, the Weaver Wade. We did a film about it, and the film, riding with one of my best mates, Jay, and it was filmed by a friend who's also running a video business. So it was basically a couple of mates piling together and said, we want to make this happen. Can we find a way to do it? And we did it, released the video, and the feedback was great. And that was kind of possibly like kind of the thing for me. It was just like, right, this is the right thing to do. There are people out there who want those sort of things, and yeah. So I kind of like gradually developed Bikepacking Scotland further. The good thing for me about doing various things at the same time that I'm pretty in a really good position that I can choose or I can switch between projects. So if there is no work coming up in terms of doing the route development, I can do my other things. So I'm fairly flexible, which is especially now I'm in a good position to kind of prioritize things every now and then. At the moment, I'm doing a lot of route development work. But out of this project, the Riva Raid, also came another project with the SYHA. And then out of that one, I met Karen Tobin, who is the development manager for Wild About Argyle. And she had a look at the stuff I've been doing. Karen is a really well-connected and a super enthusiastic person. And she said to me, look, I love what you're doing here. We've just done Wild About Argyle, the campaign with Mark Beaumont. Argyle's been pretty much the area in Scotland where I rode through when I came back from the Round the World trip. So I kind of had a personal connection to this part of Scotland as well. And she was like, I'd really like you to come here, do a route here. I'm happy to get a few partners together so we can make this a project and you can pay yourself doing that as well. And then I did the Wild About Argyle trail and also the video. And that really was kind of the crucial point where it was the first project where I could actually do what I love doing, but also it was paid for. So in the end of the day, I need to pay my bills as well. I need to kind of have a life for myself as well. So I love to do things for free every now and then, but also it's a job for me. So it kind of needs to pay as well.
And you've got to go to these places. You've got to go and have your own races as well.
Yeah. So it's a kind of thing, and then I think for quite a while it's quite interesting because I started I'm also a long distance writer, so I'm kind of like sometimes the perfect antidote to some of those things because I love riding my bike fast and putting my head down and do a race. At the same time, I also like to do a 20-kilometer loop and totally stop on every corner I can find and find out as much as I can about the region. So it's just kind of like, I think I had a Apidura, one of the companies that supports me, they tried to put me in a box and they've struggled to do that because I kind of like fitted in. I love to do grassroots events. I love to do the route development stuff, but I'm also the sort of person who would love to do, like, I'm racing and, you know, when I'm racing, I'm also taking that seriously. It's not that I just take part. If I'm in a race, I'd love to, you know, finish as best as I can.
We should explain, though, to some people who don't know. They might be thinking cycle racing. They might be thinking of stuff like the Tour de France or a crit. What we're talking about, tell me about the last big race you did.
That was the Atlas Mountain Race on a single speed. So Atlas Mountain Race is, in sheer numbers, 1,150 kilometers across the Atlas and Anti-Atlas Mountains in Morocco, fully self-sufficient, self-supported. That basically means you start with Atlas Mountain Race was about 180 other riders. You have to carry everything you need for the distance with you. You can stock up at local shops and anything which is available to everyone else. But you have to fix your bike. You have to pretty much do everything yourself.
So there's no support crew. You can't cash food. No. You can't cash water. And having cycled myself in Morocco, there are some pretty damn wild parts of Morocco.
Yes, it's a tri country. I think that was the most difficult thing for me. Like there is, we supply, and again, I think this is quite interesting for people to understand who are not like self-support races. So the biggest stretch in Morocco between two places, two shops, and you're talking about tiny shops that have hardly anything to buy, was 100 kilometers. And I think the biggest challenge on that race was fresh water, especially being a person who lives in Scotland, where you've basically got fresh water everywhere. You can drink from streams, and it's I think it's safe to drink the water. Well, you know, if you see a sheep to a stream, then you possibly don't want to drink that straight away. But Morocco is bone dry. Like, there is no water. All the riverbeds were dried up, and that made it quite tough. And I was on the single speed bike as well, so that was kind of my return to racing on the single speed bike. And I knew very well what I'm getting myself into, looking at the profile. 18,000 meters of climbing over roughly a week of riding is a lot, if you've got luggage on the bike as
well. And you probably knew you weren't going to win.
No, I think the Atlas Mountain race was interesting in a way that I had a shoulder operation in September last year. So my shoulder was dislocating frequently. I don't know, it's just, it would happen sometimes twice a week, which is not really, really good. So I knew I had to do something about it. It was just really difficult for me to find the time to actually have the operation. And then I was off the bike for 3 months afterwards. So I did that in September. And I knew, like, so I could start cycling. I'm not talking about training, when I was, just before Christmas, basically. So I didn't really have any time really to get my fitness properly back up. So Morocco was really for me going there to see if my shoulder's fine, if I can go racing.
And it was, I hope.
Oh, it was fine. It was totally okay. I had no issues whatsoever.
Because hell of a place to discover it wasn't.
Yeah, it would have been a bit brutal to do that. But again, like, I think I had the confidence that it's going to be a fight. I obviously did a few test rides beforehand, so yeah. I didn't really go out totally off the blue. And I must say, like, my surgeon was superb, and all the treatment I had, that was top notch. So, you know, I had the confidence it's going to be fine. But it was really just, like, I think for me, the decision was, like, am I going to take one of my geared bikes, or I'm going to take the single speed mountain bike? I've cycled all around the world. And the decision was driven by two things. A, riding a single speed. I was the only, I emailed Nelson, who's the race organizer, saying, look, do you know anyone else who's doing it single speed? And he's like, well, honestly, I do not really know, but I do not think so. And for me, it was just like, oh, cool, that's fine. You know, that sounds like a good idea then, to take a single speed, just to kind of see if it's possible. And the other thing is, Lois, I've ridden this bike across various different continents. I've never been to Africa before, and Africa wasn't part of my round the world trip. So the idea of taking that bike, I've spent so many days riding around the world on, dusted off, put it back in a box, which had to be a big box because my seat post is stuck. It's corroded in since Southeast Asia. So logistically, I just kind of like, there was a bit of a challenge, but it's fine. It worked out in the end. And I was just like, I want to take this bike. You know, I'm not the sort of person who would put the bike into a museum. It would be lovely for people to have a look at it. And I've been taking it, some tracking about exhibitions for a few years now. But it was just nice to take that very bike that's done so much back to Morocco.
And yeah, it deserved it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so yeah. It was great. And yeah, I was the only single speeder, so for me literally I just had to finish. there is no such thing as winning a category there. But I timed it well because I arrived, there's a finisher's party, so you have to do it in a certain cutoff time. I was 4 hours below the cutoff time, so it was fine. I was well within the limit. But I also arrived when the party with all the riders was just about to start, so there couldn't have been a better timing than that.
Great timing. Happy in a party when he can get there, yet equally happy in his own head for hours or days at a time. A message for us all right now. If you'd like to get some ideas for bikepacking in Scotland once all this crisis is over, check his website, bikepackingscotland.com. If you've enjoyed this, also check out my podcast with wilderness cyclist Lee Craigie, who's a mountain bike champion, founder of the Adventure Syndicate, and Active Nation Commissioner for Scotland. If it's not yet published, please subscribe, and you'll not miss it or anything else. I'm Simon Willis. Thanks for listening. Until next time. Bye.